Miles Davis in jazz history. While we listen to Miles' greatest recordings, from bebop and cool to hard bop, modal and funk, in that order, she gave me a detailed explanation. She ended her lecture with, "Miles is jazz." I pulled her close and kissed her. Other times, we spent the entire day caressing each other. We touched and kissed each other gently while our favorite music played. But we didn't touch each other down there. We had a silent understanding that this wasn't the place we were going to give ourselves completely to each other. We were both fearful that if we went too far, our desires would get the better of us, and we might violate that understanding. I kissed the nape of Sakurai's neck while gently caressing her back. Sakurai preferred being kissed on the nape of the neck rather than on her breasts. When I ran my fingers over the curves of her back, she'd let out a deep and heavy breath. Then she'd whisper into my ear repeatedly, "You're amazing." Sakurai liked to kiss my muscles. Her favorites were my biceps, deltoids, and abdominals. Sometimes she'd bite down on my biceps and growl. Sakurai always planted a kiss on every square of my six-pack. The first time we took off our tops, there was an odd moment when we'd finished caressing each other. Maybe embarrassed by having to put our clothes back on, we got dressed in silence. A Brahms piano concerto was playing. I finished dressing first, so I asked the question to fill the awkward silence. "I wonder what country Brahms was from." Sakurai stopped for a moment after fastening her bra and said, "I'm not sure, but I don't think it really matters where he's from. People all over the world appreciate Brahms." I went up to Sakurai and leaned my body against her, gently pushing her down on the sofa. I rested my head on her chest with my right ear down. The sound of music died, and I could only hear Sakurai's heartbeat. Sakurai's heart didn't beat at the same steady pace, but was always changing. She gently patted the top of my head and kissed it three times. It was a ritual we went through after we had finished caressing each other. I would listen to Sakurai's heartbeat, and she would kiss the top of my head three times. Then we would leave the media room, reluctantly. Sakurai and I wanted every bit of each other. There was no mistaking it. But the place where we were going to give ourselves completely to each other had to be special. We concluded that we would go somewhere with a beautiful view of the ocean, and that going there with our parents' money wouldn't be cool. We were going to go someplace special, with money we'd made ourselves, and give ourselves to each other. Where that place was, or how much money we'd need to get there, neither of us had any idea. We decided to get started anyway. Summer vacation was coming up. We decided to cut back on seeing each other and put our energies into part-time work. I spent a good portion of the summer break working part-time as a dishwasher at Naomi-san's restaurant. Jong-il was working there with me. He was trying to save up to pay for the college admission exams. "So, how have you been doing?" Jong-il asked with a meaningful smile one day during break period. I hadn't told him about Sakurai yet, but after I'd turned down a couple of his invitations to hang out, he must have sensed something and stopped asking out of consideration to me. "She's really great," I answered. "I'll introduce her to you soon, I promise." Jong-il didn't ask anything more and simply said that he was looking forward to meeting her. Usually, we'd talk about stuff like why black people were able to produce the blues, jazz, hip-hop, and rap, but Zainichi couldn't create their own unique culture. But on this day, we talked about mindless trash, like whether we would die for Kim Basinger, whether Ringo would be the obvious choice if we had to fire one of the Beatles, and whether Superman's piston action would be really super, and laughed our heads off. Toward the end of our break, Jong-il stopped laughing and asked, as if he'd just remembered, "Do you remember the test of courage?" "What are you talking about?" "Crazy? You really were something else," said Jong-il, narrowing his eyes at me.
"But you weren't there at the platform, were you?"
Jong-il shook his head. "I was there. away from where you and your group were, and I saw you. The test of courage was a test of nerves that was passed down as tradition in my junior high school. I called it the Super Great Chicken Race. The game was very simple. Stand at the edge of the train platform, jump down onto the tracks when the train was 50 meters away from pulling into the platform, and run down the track from one edge of the platform to the other. The story was, you were supposed to be able to outrun the train without getting killed if you ran a 12-second 100-meter dash, but since it's likely someone at my school made that calculation, the story lacked credibility. Whatever the case, if you tripped, you were history. If you got freaked and stopped midway, you were history. If you were too slow and let the train catch you, you were history. If you escaped underneath the platform or to the adjacent track, you were given the title of queen and were treated as everyone's errand boy, so you were pretty much history anyway. In short, if you were going to do the challenge, you had no choice but to succeed. Given the severity of the rules, few challengers stepped forward, and only two people had ever succeeded before I came along. One was a senpai about 12 years my senior, who later became a bullet, a hitman for the Yakuza, who was sent into action because he was expendable, and died. The other was Tawake. I decided to take the challenge to commemorate my citizenship changing from North Korean to South Korean. At the time, I was able to run 100 meters somewhere in the 11-second range, so I was confident that I would succeed. In the end, I came out of it with flying colors, but because I had tried it all, everyone started to believe that I really was crazy. The two senpai who'd succeeded before me had deliberately dropped a 10,000 yen bill on the track, creating a situation of having to retrieve it in order to psych themselves up. I had simply hopped down on the track and outran the train without dropping anything. After some hesitation, I decided to tell Jung-il the secret to my success. The trick was that I had secretly invited a girl I liked to the train station to watch. The plan, of course, was for her to witness my brave act and fall head over heels for me. But that plan failed spectacularly. The girl didn't have a clue how men's minds worked. She said, "Maybe you should get your head examined at the hospital." Jung-il cackled with pure delight at my story. After a while, he composed himself and said, "If I were a girl, I'd fall for you." I said, "Right?" and tilted my head. "You were really something else that day," said Jung-il, smiling tenderly at me. "For some reason, I remember that image of you running a lot lately. When I'm walking down the street or taking a bath, when I least expect it. I wonder why."
"Maybe you should get your head examined at the hospital."
Jung-il and I looked at each other and burst out laughing. On our way back to the kitchen after our break, I said, "We should talk about crap like this more often." Jung-il gave me that good-natured smile of his and nodded. Every moment I could spare from my part-time job, I spent seeing Sakurai. Sakurai had gotten a job as a telephone operator through her father's connections at work. Basically, she answered phone calls, which not only was a pretty easy job, but paid well, too. Sakurai had kept a savings account since childhood. Add that to what she earned at her job, and she already had quite a sum saved up. I was shocked to hear the amount of money she had when she told me once. She really didn't need to be working that much at all. During one of our dates, Sakurai said, "Let's take the mock exams together." She took out a blank application form from a famous cram school for a mock college entrance exam and handed it to me. "You're planning to go to university, right?" she asked. I nodded slightly. "Then you should definitely take it as practice." As she said this, Sakurai looked longingly at me. How could I refuse? I nodded. She smiled, and so, on a Sunday toward the end of August, I went with Sakurai and took the mock exams for the first time. The results would be announced about a month later. One night toward the end of summer vacation, I got a phone call from Kato.
"I've got a great gig for you."
It was a job as a bouncer at a dance party Kato was organizing. Hosting dance parties was a thing at my high school. It was an easy way to get girls and earn a nice profit from ticket sales. But amateurs that tried to get in on the action got hurt. There were more than a few flies buzzing around that sweet deal. Naturally, a war over profits ensued. A fly that didn't have muscle was easily squashed. Battles with organizers from other schools over ticket sales and customers were always raging. Things would sometimes get violent, and those battles ended with a ride down to the police station. The party organizer would see his cred go down and customers disappear when that happened, so he tried to avoid trouble when he could. That's when bouncers were necessary. The more there were, the less chance of enemies crashing the party. But to my knowledge, none of Kato's dance parties had ever suffered an enemy attack. Anyone that dared to crash one of Kato's dance parties without fear of his old man had to be one crazy bastard. "Some guys get drunk and get out of hand," said Kato. "I'm asking you to bounce them out when that happens." Kato had a number of henchmen working for him. He certainly didn't need me in that role. I asked him how much he was paying. It was roughly the amount I earned in a month washing dishes at Naomi-san's restaurant. Kato knew that I was trying to save up for Sakurai. "You sure?" I asked. "Come on, don't be a pain."
"I owe you one."
"Sure. See you next Saturday." Saturday night, I headed for Z, the club where Kato had his birthday party. I entered the club and, just as the last time, was greeted by the pulse of electronica, cigarette smoke, the smell of alcohol, and body heat, along with the sight of Takeshita taking tickets. Takeshita pointed to the table I'd sat at before. Every table in the club was full except for that one. I gave Takeshita a pat on the back and made my way to the table. I sat down. Since I didn't have anything to do, I opened up the paperback I'd brought and began reading by the flame of the spirit lamp on the table. It was In Exile, the book I'd borrowed from Jung-il a while back. Things had been so hectic that I'd hardly touched it since Jung-il lent it to me. Two glasses filled with iced oolong tea appeared on the table. I looked up and found Kato. I was so focused on the book that I hadn't noticed him. I closed the book at the same time Kato sat down across from me. "Sorry, I'm not a snow spirit," he said, making a reference to the night I'd met Sakurai. Kato and I exchanged a look and laughed. "You guys getting along?" I nodded.
"Yeah," I muttered.
After taking a sip from his glass, Kato asked, "Does the snow spirit know about you?"
"How do you mean?"
"I mean, does she know everything about you?"
"I'm thinking about telling her. Soon."
Scratching his head, Kato said, "Probably none of my business anyway," and drank the rest of his tea. Then he asked, "What are you planning on doing after high school?"
"I haven't really decided yet," I answered.
"Then why don't we team up and expand our turf?"
"Expand?
Just what are you thinking about doing?" Kato leaned slightly out of his seat. "I'm going to manage a club. It's going to be off the hook. One of those cutting-edge clubs where all the celebrities hang out. Why don't we do it together?"
"If you're looking for a bouncer, you'd be better off with some has-been soldier from one of the American military bases."
He shook his head with irritation. "I'm not making you a bouncer. We're going to be co-managers."
"I don't have any money."
"Money?" he spat out. "My father will give us all the money we need. I just want to keep you close is all."
"You're not gay, are you?"
I joked, trying to get Kato to slow down.
"Hardcore?"
Kato didn't even crack a smile. "People like you and me have been handicapped our whole lives. We're like twins. If people like us are going to get anywhere in this country, we can't just walk in through the front door. You get that, don't you? We can lay low in the shadows and make it big and stick it to all the uppity, miserable bastards that ever discriminated against us. Because we can do that. Because we're meant for greatness." I stared at the beads of sweat on the outside of the glass and said nothing. Kato's body twitched as if to prompt an answer. Raising my eyes from the glass, I said,
"You and I are nothing alike.
We're different.
A deep frown line creased his forehead. Kato opened his mouth to protest when,
"Stop!"
There was the high-pitched cry of a girl from the dance floor below. Kato choked back what he was about to say and left his seat. As his resident bouncer, I got up and looked down on the floor from the railing. There was a guy and girl tussling in the middle of the dance floor. The guy looked familiar. He looked like a kid, Kobayashi, in the same year as me at school. The rumor had been that the poser was talking trash behind my back about kicking my ass. Kobayashi had grabbed the girl by the elbow and was pulling her toward him. The girl cried, "Stop!" again and slapped him hard across the face. With the sound of the slap, almost everyone stopped dancing and began to move away as if on cue. The DJ stopped the music. Realizing all eyes were trained on him, Kobayashi was faced with having to choose between one of two moves. Naturally, he made the wrong one. The sound of his palm connecting with the girl's face echoed across the floor. Pressing a hand against her cheek, the girl shouted, "Scumbag!" as Kobayashi's hand went into motion again. Kato's voice rained down from above.
"Hey!"
Kobayashi stopped and turned his eyes up at Kato and me. Slowly he lowered his hand, but his eyes were bloodshot, and he looked as if he might come after us at any moment. Kato looked down at him with a sneer smeared across his lips. That was a mistake. Unable to back down amid the stares of the crowd, Kobayashi made another bad move.
"Think you're pretty big with that damn chong next to you?"
Chong. The nasty Japanese word for Korean had a familiar ring to it. It was an epithet that I'd had hurled at me at least 50 times from as far back as I could remember. And I'd responded to it with my fists at least 50 times. Kato looked at me. I shrugged. Kato made like he was going downstairs, so I grabbed him by the arm and stopped him. Again, Kobayashi shouted from below.
"Come on down, chon boy, or maybe you'd like to go back to your country with your tail between your legs."
A shadow came over Kato's eyes. I let go of his arm and said, "See what I mean? We're different." Leaving Kato standing on the loft, I went down the stairs to the dance floor. The entire club was heated with a tension that could burn your skin. I closed the distance between Kobayashi and me until we were a yard apart. His face was twisted into an ambiguous expression. It wasn't clear whether he was crying or laughing. I stared at the strange look on his face and said, "Do you know the meaning of the country name Japan?" For an instant, the strangeness of the question broke the tension in his face. I drilled him in the face dead center with a straight punch, a good right. Kobayashi let out a grunt, covered his nose, and sank to the floor. I looked down at him and waited to finish him off. After removing his hand from his nose and seeing the blood on his palm, Kobayashi reached into his pants pocket and pulled out something metallic. Shwing, 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 shwing! It unfolded into a butterfly knife in Kobayashi's hand. The crowd gulped in horror. Kobayashi slowly got to his feet. I had no intention of entertaining the crowd with a show, so I landed a right toe kick in the groin, where he was completely defenseless. There was drool coming out of his mouth as Kobayashi doubled over on the floor again. Bringing my foot back down, I circled behind him and pushed the back of his head with my foot. Kobayashi slowly tilted forward until he lay flat, spread out on the floor like a pinned frog waiting to be dissected. Kobayashi was still gripping his precious butterfly knife. I brought my foot down on his wrist. The knife came out of his hand. After picking it up, I put one foot on the base of his head, the medulla, and put my weight on it. If he struggled too hard, his spine would snap. I said, "If you bring a knife to a fight, you're asking to get cut by one." What the hell am I saying? The lower half of Kobayashi's body began to tremble. "Besides, I could stab you with this knife, and it would be self-defense. You were the one that pulled a knife on me. I have plenty of witnesses." I took a look around. Not a single person would look me in the eye. What the hell am I doing here? "I should stab you in the stomach, but I'll let you off easy this time. I either slice off both your ears or cut off your thumbs. You choose. Put up one finger if you say ears, two fingers for the thumbs.
This isn't what I want to say at all.
Kobayashi balled his hands into fists, refusing to answer. His whole body was twitching almost imperceptibly.
Both then.
I started to move, and Kobayashi let out a girlish scream, causing a chain reaction of cries from the girls in the crowd.
Let him go,
a voice called out from behind. I turned around and saw Kato.
Let him go, he said again.
Kato and I silently looked each other in the eye. I folded up the knife, and after tossing it to Kato, I took my foot off the base of Kobayashi's head. I walked past Kato, went up the stairs to the loft, grabbed a copy of In Exile I'd left on the table, and headed for the door. Every eye in the club was focused on me. Kato and Takeshita were standing side by side at the door. Takeshita looked down, avoiding eye contact with me. Kato took out a wad of bills from his pants pocket. Taking my eyes off the money, I looked at Kato. He looked like he was about to cry any second.
I'm sorry, he said.
I gave Kato a gentle pat on the back, opened the door, and went out. A muggy summer wind blew in my face. The moon was hidden behind thick clouds. I started walking in the direction of Tokyo Tower. Despite taking several wrong turns along the way, I managed to find the elementary school from that night with Sakurai. As I stood in a daze in front of the iron gate that Sakurai had straddled so proudly, it began to rain. Leaning up against the gate, I let the rain hit me for a while. I recalled the last training session I had with my father.
I wonder if heaven really is a good place.
I thought of jumping up and down like my father did that night, but decided against it. The rain coming down was pathetic. It was barely a drizzle. I prayed for it to rain harder, but it was no good. The rain was already beginning to let up.
Why didn't I jump then, with my father, when I had the chance?
Summer vacation ended, and the second semester began. I had saved up just enough to go to Okinawa, so Sakurai and I decided to go to the beaches there. Now it was all just a matter of when. We decided to carefully devise a plan. Kato stopped turning up. In fact, he didn't seem to be coming to school at all. I figured he was on another trip and didn't think much of it. The results of the mock exams came back. To my surprise, my academic rating went up from about the calories of an egg white to that of egg custard. Reading all those dense books might have helped. After seeing my scores, Sakurai turned glum and said, "That's great," several times. She didn't show me her scores.
"Let's get out of here," she said, with a depressed look on her face.
We left the fast food restaurant that was near the cram school. Sakurai's feet pointed not in the direction of the nearest train station, but in a different direction.
"Let's walk a little to the next station."
I nodded and fell in line next to her. For a while, we walked in silence. Sakurai did all the things that a child might do, like kick at the stones on the pavement and touch every one of the telephone poles along the street. We walked for about 15 minutes and came to a bus stop with a bench.
"Let's sit down," Sakurai said.
We took a seat on the bench.
"So what's going on?" I asked.
Sakurai let out a breath and said,
"I feel so stupid. I mean, really lame."
I waited in silence for her to continue.
"My scores were worse than the last time. I tend to get pretty depressed about stuff like this. Even knowing how colossally silly it is, I can't help it."
"I don't think it's silly," I said.
"Really?" said Sakurai. "You don't think I'm being lame for getting depressed over some test scores?"
"You took the test seriously, right?"
"Yes."
"Then there's nothing wrong with getting depressed. I'd say that's natural."
"Why?"
"If someone took the test, didn't get the scores they wanted, and was laughing about it like they didn't give a damn, that would be lame. Whether it's a test or the 100-meter dash in the Olympics, I don't think it's any different."
Sakurai looked me in the eyes and asked,
Do you really think so?
100%. A relieved look came over her face.
Do you ever get depressed, Sugihara?
I nodded. Of course I do.
About what, for example?
About a lot of things. Leaning forward, Sakurai peered up at my eyes.
If you're depressed, I hope you'll talk to me about it.
I nodded. Sakurai was in high spirits the rest of the way to the station and kept body-checking me.
Do you know what my sister said?
Sakurai asked while landing a roundhouse kick to my thigh.
She said you were very good-looking, especially the way your eyes are so sharp and intense. She said you're like a classic Japanese man.
Spotting a plastic frog on display outside a pharmacy, Sakurai cheered and ran toward it. Gazing at her from behind, I went back and forth over whether I should tell her everything about me. But the instant I saw her slamming a roundhouse kick into the frog's body, nothing seemed to matter. I ran over next to her and drilled the frog in the head with a roundhouse kick. A man who might have been the manager came out of the pharmacy, yelling, "What do you think you're doing?" So we took off down the street. Sakurai grabbed my hand as we ran. I squeezed her hand firmly in mine. We ran with all our might. By all appearances, everything was going great. One Tuesday, the first week into October, I received a call from Jong-il. A quiet rain was falling that night.
"How about we meet on Sunday?" he said excitedly.
"I've got plans that day,"
Jong-il persisted. "Come on, just for a little while."
"Is it something you can tell me over the phone?"
"No, I want to tell you face to face."
"What's this about?"
"Something really awesome."
"Awesome how?"
"Listen, it's something I really want to tell you about, something only you'd understand."
I conjured up my schedule for that day in my head and said, "How about afternoon?"
"What time?"
"Between 1 and 3.
"Perfect."
"Same place as usual?"
1 o'clock, at the east exit of Shinjuku Station.
"Okay. Come on, just give me a clue."
"See you Sunday."
He hung up.
5. There was a 17-year-old boy who went to high school in Tokyo. He fell in love with a girl that he always saw on the train platform on his way to school. It was love at first sight. She was also a student at a high school in Tokyo and was very pretty. Every time he saw her, his heart ached terribly. He didn't know how to tell her what he was feeling. To begin with, he had no idea what language to use to speak to a girl like her. None of the adults in his life had taught him about such things, nor had he been taught much about people of her kind. She wore a chima chogori, the traditional girl's uniform of North Korean schools. After some hesitation, the boy confided in his friends. Naturally, they teased him and goaded him on, saying, "We'll be standing right next to you when you tell her." The boy didn't have it in him to protest. He was a shy and delicate boy. One of his friends said, "Keep this to psych yourself up," and gave him a butterfly knife. One Wednesday morning, the boy and his friends gathered on the platform. She appeared before them at the same time she usually arrived. The girl's beauty took the boy's breath away. A passenger nearby overheard one of the boys say, perhaps out of jealousy, "If you get turned down by a Korean girl, you have to be our errand boy." Goaded on by his friends, the boy timidly approached the girl. He stood diagonally behind her. The girl trembled reflexively. North Korean terrorism, suspicions of abductions of Japanese citizens, and the nuclear program were burdens the girl wearing the chima chogori was made to bear on her slender shoulders. Once she'd been punched in the shoulder by a 50-ish salaryman on this very platform. Fearful, she turned around and caught sight of the boy blinking nervously before her. He looked familiar. He'd been on the same train car several times and had glared at her with a terrifying look. Holding her bag up to her chest, she unconsciously braced herself and asked, "What is it?" What must he have been feeling just then? Intimidated by the overwhelming beauty of her voice? or shocked by the realization that she could speak Japanese. He just stared at her face, saying nothing. Shrinking under his gaze, threatened, she looked all around her, crying for help inside. The surrounding passengers quickly averted their eyes so as not to get caught looking. A student came up the stairs and emerged onto the platform. As if it were the most natural thing in the world, he met her gaze and heard her silent cries for help. He was her senpai. He despised North Korea for making his kohai suffer in this way, despised the misguided Japanese who bullied the weak. He quickly went to the boy and shoved him in the back. I couldn't bring myself to blame him for his mistake. If I were there, I would have done the same thing. He and I were given to making such assumptions in the circumstances we lived in, always. The boy stumbled forward, and after righting himself, turned around. A male student in a school blazer was standing there, staring at him with a serious look. For a second, they stared each other down, quiet. According to the stories in the papers, the boy later told the police that he believed that the other guy was the girl's boyfriend and was out to hurt him. He was scared. He had felt ashamed and embarrassed because everyone was looking at him. He couldn't remember what happened next. An announcement that a train was arriving came over the PA. As if it were some kind of cue, the boy pulled out a butterfly knife from his jacket pocket, clumsily unfolded the knife, and pointed it toward the student's chest. The student had never been in a fistfight before, and obviously never had a knife pointed at him before. Even when I, a seasoned brawler, had a knife pulled on me for the first time, I felt all the pores on my body open up in an instant and almost peed in my pants. The student, Jong-il, was braver than I was. Without flinching, he edged closer to the boy to try to knock the knife out of his hand with his bag. I should have told him that when I had a knife pulled on me for the first time, I ran faster than Carl Lewis. That the only people who survive in this world are cowards, and that true heroes are destined to die young. That the world needed him, so if anyone pulled a knife on him, he had to run faster than a speeding bullet. As he stepped forward, Jung-il raised his bag up over his head and swung down with all his might. The boy threw his free hand up in front of his face and took the hit. The distance between them closed. When Jung-il raised the bag again, the terrified boy reflexively swung the knife upward in a diagonal motion. It happened at the same moment Jung-il leaned in as he swung his bag again. The knife plunged into the carotid artery running down the left side of Jung-il's neck. The boy pulled back the knife as if to shake off the horrible sensation running up his arm, and Jung-il's bag came down on the knife. The knife clattered as it hit the ground. The train pulled onto the platform. Jung-il instinctively pressed his palm up against where the knife had been. Blood began to spray out like a shower from between his fingers. Having seen everything up close from beginning to end, the girl opened her eyes wide, parted her lips slightly, and let out a silent scream. In the blink of an eye, and I truly mean in the time it takes to blink, the white shirt beneath Jong-il's blazer seeped with dark blood. Seeing the blood, the boy pitched forward and began to throw up everything in his stomach. Jong-il fell to his knees on the platform. The girl put her tiny hands over Jong-il's hand, covering the carotid artery. In an instant, her hands were soaked in blood. The train came to a stop and opened its doors. Not a single passenger boarded the train from the door nearest Jong-il, the girl and the boy.
"Please call an ambulance!" cried the girl to no one in particular.
Turning a deaf ear to the girl's plea, passengers filed into the train in an orderly fashion. Again, the girl cried toward the many doors sliding closed,
"Please call an ambulance!"
As if nothing had happened, the train pulled out of the platform and headed for the next station. The friends who had goaded the boy on had disappeared. Finally, a young station attendant appeared.
"Is anything the matter?"
"Please, call an ambulance!"
The attendant, reacting to the desperation of her cry, rushed immediately to the station master's office. Jung-il's limp body slumped against the girl. She caught him. She sat down on the floor, holding him in her arms from behind, and rested his body on her lap. There was nothing more she could do for him. From the time the ambulance arrived to when the gurney was finally brought over, she glared, first at the boy still vomiting in front of her, and then at the curious onlookers ogling from afar. When the paramedics finally came with the gurney, she cried inconsolably, large tears falling down her cheeks. Zhongyue bled out. By the time the ambulance got to the hospital, it was already too late. The police arrested the boy. Due to his diminished mental state, the interrogation was cut short, and he was sent to a detention house. The boy suffered from a severe cause of diarrhea in the middle of the night and became dehydrated. He was taken out of detention and sent to a university hospital nearby. Hospital staff was preparing the boy's IV in a room on the sixth floor with its large window half open. Apparently, it happened very quickly. The boy, who until then had been lying in bed, unable to walk, suddenly rushed to the window, slid it all the way open, and put one foot on the windowsill. He stopped and turned around, and after muttering, "Sorry," in the general direction of the staff in the room, climbed over the windowsill and threw himself into the darkness. The boy and Zhongyue died on the same day. The hospital was also the same hospital Zhongyue had been taken to. It was a tragedy. There was no two ways about it. But whatever the tragedy, people are desperate to find even a fragment of salvation. I was no different. 2 days after the incident, I talked to an old friend from my Korean school days, and he gave me an account of the girl on the platform. Zhongyue lay slumped in the girl's lap when suddenly his head moved. There was a faint smile on his pale face. His gaze was directed at the track, his eyes slowly moving as if he were watching a train pull into the platform. Zhongyue had been watching me run down the track. I was sure of it. I wanted it to be true. And what was the problem if it was? The night of the incident, I learned about Zhongyue's death through a phone call from his mother. Not even 24 hours had passed since Zhongyue's call the night before.
"Zhongyue has died,"
Zhongyue's mother said as soon as I answered the phone. Her voice sounded clearer than usual and very beautiful. I wasn't fully able to grasp the meaning of the words and could only utter, "Huh?" And as if my voice was some kind of cue, she began to cry. Her feeble sobs trickled into my ears. I restrained myself from asking too many questions and listened to Zhongyue's mother sobbing. The phone beeped several times, signaling a call on the other line. I ignored the call, silently cursing whoever it was that invented call waiting. After crying for nearly 20 minutes, Zhongyue's mother apologized and explained what had happened.
"Zhongyue adored you, Sugihara-kun. Thank you for being his friend," she said, before hanging up the phone.
I only answered, "Yes." After hanging up the phone, I lay on my bed and stared at the ceiling. I must have stared for about an hour, but what I'd been thinking about, I can't remember. I got up and went into the living room. My mother was gone, away on a trip with Naomi-san in Phuket. My father was watching an instructional video on golf. "Zhongyue's dead." My father pressed stop on the remote control and turned off the TV. I told him what had happened. After listening to my story, he muttered, "I see," and let out a deep sigh. Then he got up off the sofa, came up to me, and roughing up my hair, said, "Try not to think too hard about it. For now, it's best you cry your eyes out and eat whatever the hell you want." I nodded. I said thanks and left. A few minutes after I returned to my room, the phone rang. I pressed the button on the handset and it was Sakurai on the line.
"You didn't pick up earlier," she said.
I wavered over telling her about Zhongyue, but in the end, I decided against it. I didn't have the energy or confidence to clearly explain to her everything that had happened. "I just have a lot going on right now," I said. "Can I call you tomorrow?" After a brief silence, Sakurai asked, "Did something happen?"
"I'll tell you about it soon, I promise."
"Okay. So, I guess I'll talk to you tomorrow."
As I moved to hang up the phone, Sakurai hastily said, as if she had just remembered,
"You remember our date on Sunday, right?"
"Yeah."
"Oh, good."
I hung up the phone.
Sunday morning, I left the house. Soon after Sakurai and I started dating, we'd promised to go to the opera together as part of our hunt for cool stuff.
Neither of us had seen an opera before.
We had been listening to famous operas on CD and picking out the ones we might like to actually see. The Marriage of Figaro, Tannhauser, Madama Butterfly, The Knight of the Rose, Cavalleria Rusticana, La Traviata. I said that I wanted to see Cavalleria Rusticana, and Sakurai said she really wanted to see La Traviata. Naturally, I was the one to cave. We agreed to go see La Traviata, but unfortunately there were no performances in the near future. Sakurai was planning to spend several months, starting in November, studying for the entrance exams, so we only had until October. Then we discovered Cavalleria Rusticana was going to be playing in the middle of October. We bought the tickets for a shocking amount of money in the beginning of August and began studying up on the opera. We learned the lyrics and storyline by listening to the CD countless times in the media room. We steadily carried out preparations for attending our first opera. Everything was set. So when I called Sakurai and canceled on Saturday, the night before the performance, she sounded pretty upset. "Why?"
"I have to go to a funeral for a friend." She fell silent for a moment and then asked,
"When did your friend die?"
"Wednesday."
"Why didn't you tell me until today?"
I couldn't answer.
"That's messed up, definitely."
"You're right." For a while, there was a heavy silence between us.
"Was he an old friend?"
asked Sakurai. "Yeah."
"Is it that I'm not reliable or something?"
"Why do you think that?"
"If I had an old friend die, I would definitely tell you about it and ask you to help me through it. Besides, didn't I tell you to talk to me if you're ever depressed?"
"I'm sorry, but this doesn't have anything to do with you being reliable or not, really. I'll tell you about it soon, I promise." Sakurai said nothing more to try to make me feel guilty. I asked her to go with someone else so the ticket wouldn't go to waste, and she answered disappointedly,
"Maybe I will."
Since I overshot my intended train station by 2 stops and the bus stop by 3, I was nearly an hour late to the funeral. When I went inside the enormous hall not too far from Jung-il's house, the funeral had already come to the climax, and Jung-il's uncle on his mother's side was giving a speech. Despite wondering why Jung-il's mother wasn't giving the speech, I shook it off and in a daze stared at Jung-il's mother holding a framed portrait of Jung-il in her arms as the uncle droned on. She looked terribly worn out. During the 10 minutes I listened to his speech, the uncle must have said, "Jung-il didn't live to see his 20th birthday. 3 times. I felt dizzy every time he said it. The funeral ended. The attendant said, "A light meal has been prepared for everyone, so please make your way to the 2nd floor. I weaved past the others, going upstairs and caught up with Jung-il's mom. We'd only had a chance to exchange silent bows at the wake, so I wanted to give her a proper greeting. I stood in front of her. She took one look at me, and after letting out a sigh so deep she might deflate into nothing, she began to cry on my chest. The corner of the picture frame containing Jung-il's portrait hit me several times on the chin. Jung-il's mother cried.
"Why did he have to die?"
I stood absolutely still and listened as she continued to sob. A man who might have been an uncle came by and pulled her away from my chest.
As I watched her being ushered into the room where Jong-il would be cremated, someone hit me on the shoulder from behind. When I turned around, a bunch of guys wearing school blazers were standing in front of me. I gave the one I'd assumed had hit me a gentle punch in the stomach. Won-soo jokingly grabbed his stomach with both hands and said with a smile on his rough, square-jawed face, "Long time no see. You never call." "You too." We smiled at each other somewhat awkwardly. Won-soo and I had been partners in crime since elementary school. Anytime I was up to no good, he was always by my side. It was Won-soo who hit the cop car with the paint-filled water balloon and who went on the trip to Nagoya with me. And by the way, Won-soo was the one who tailed me, spied me going into a cram school, and then ratted me out to everyone back in the third year of junior high. Since I'd started going to a Japanese high school, we hadn't seen each other once.
"You haven't gotten chicken on me, have you?"
said Won-soo, drawing his face up to mine. His breath reeked of nicotine. I punched him in the stomach hard this time. Won-soo let out a groan.
"We had a deal."
Won-soo and I made a promise to quit smoking in the summer of our second year in junior high school. The deal was, if we caught the other breaking that promise, we were allowed to punch him as punishment, no complaints. Rubbing his belly with a satisfied smile, Won-soo said,
"Why don't we kick up some trouble tomorrow, like the old days?"
"Doing what?"
"We're going on a manhunt."
"For who?"
"The bastard friends of the kid who killed Jong-il."
"You know who they are?"
"Damn if I know," Won-soo spat out. "I'm sure if we grab someone that goes to the same school and knock them around a little, they'll talk."
Saying nothing, I looked into Wonsu's eyes. Then I looked at the familiar faces of the old friends standing behind me. They looked hungry for a sacrifice.
"Forget it," I said.
"What was that?" A deep line creased his brow. "What happened to Jong-il got some attention in the media. You know the police are going to be watching the schools to keep a lid on things."
"So what?"
A dark look of violence came over Won-soo's face.
"You want us to forget what happened because of the police? Is that it?"
"What do you think is going to happen if you go after those bastards? It's not going to bring..." Won-soo cut me off mid-sentence, jabbing his two fingers against my chest. He quickly pulled them back and gave them a curious stare. His fingers had touched the part of my chest that Jong-il's mom had been crying on. After wiping the damp tips of his fingers on his blazer, he said,
"So are you in or out? Which is it?"
"I'm out," I said plainly, "and Jong-il wouldn't want this either."
"Don't bullshit me," said Won-soo in a muted voice. "It's a tragedy what happened to Jong-il, but he's dead. Gone. Which is why it's up to us, the living, to settle the score that he left behind. And the person Jong-il wants most to do it is you. But here you are, talking like some kind of chicken."
"Listen to yourself," I answered in a choked voice. "What do you know about Jong-il? Did any of you even take the time to talk to him? You're only looking to start trouble. In that case, why don't you go mess around with some gangs?" A terrible air of violence hung over where we stood. Won-soo's glare, shared by the bunch behind me, seemed to stab me until it hurt. I let out a short sigh and said, "Let Jong-il go in peace."
"What's happened to you?"
asked Won-soo with a troubled look.
"Did you sell your soul to the Japanese in that school of yours?"
Hearing the word soul reminded me of the time Jong-il recited the passage about the Japanese spirit from I Am a Cat. But I couldn't remember how it went. After some thought, I said, "I don't know anything about souls. But if I had something like a North Korean soul, I wouldn't think twice about selling it. You guys want to buy it?" Won-soo looked at me with a distant gaze.
"Come on. Don't look at me like that. Did you forget? You and I didn't have money for a hotel the night we got to Nagoya, so we ended up sleeping in the parking lot next to the pachinko parlor. We lay spread out on the asphalt, looking up at the stars, and talked about going as far away as possible." "We can do that, Won-soo.
We can go right now.
Wonsu jabbed me in the chest again with two fingers.
I'm finished with you. The next time you see me on the street, keep on walking. If you so much as try to get close to me, I'll jump you.
To the others, he said,
Let's go.
They made their way past me. One of them, in passing, whispered contemptuously in my ear,
Traitor, friendless bat.
After they all walked past me, I turned around only once. Wonsu had stopped and was looking at me. His face was frighteningly expressionless. I forced a smile on my face and directed it at Wonsu. He ignored me and turned his back. I left the funeral hall. I overshot my intended bus stop by 4 stops, got on the bus going back in the opposite direction, and then overshot the stop again by 5 this time. By the time I got to the train station, it was early evening.
Friendless bat.
Going down the stairs to the train platform, for some reason, I heard the voice echoing in my ear.
God, I wish I were a bat. I could fly away anywhere, I thought,
when a sudden dizziness came over me, causing me to almost lose my balance. I did an ass plant in the middle of the stairs. The dizziness quickly went away, but then my chest began to hurt. I let out a low groan. It was in my second year of junior high school. The basketball team that I played on had advanced to the finals of the national tournament for North Korean schools. Maybe it was because the team we were playing against was from Osaka, but the game took on the atmosphere of a Giants versus Hanshin rivalry game and became strangely heated. Things got so physical on the court that players were hurt. Fights even broke out in the stands, causing more injuries. I was playing point guard and took 4 punches in the face by the kid guarding me. I got him back with a knee kick, elbow, headbutt, and finger in the eye. The ref caught me poking the kid in the eye and charged me with a foul. We lost the game by 1 point. Afterward, we went into the locker room and hung our heads in silence. Had any one of us started crying, it would likely have infected the whole team in an instant, and we would have all burst into tears. The coach came inside the locker room with the school principal.
You did a good job. I'm proud of all of you.
Upon hearing these words, one of the first-year players began to cry. Just as everyone's cry button was about to get switched on, the coach went up to the first year, pulled back his arm like an Olympic discus thrower, and smacked him across the face. The kid went flying and slammed into the lockers with a great big crash. The rest of us shuddered at the sound. In a terribly calm tone, the coach said to no one in particular,
"Never cry in front of others. You boys live your lives surrounded by enemies. Shedding tears before the enemy is the same as begging for pity. The same as admitting defeat. Your admitting defeat means all North Koreans are admitting defeat. That's why you can't ever get into the habit of crying in front of others. If you want to cry, go do it alone in the privacy of your room."
The coach glanced over at the principal. The principal gave a slight nod, as if nothing had happened. The coach said,
"Now hurry up and get dressed. The principal would like to take you to dinner as a reward for your efforts today."
The coach and principal went out of the locker room. A heavy pall hung over the room. A third-year senpai went over to the first-year who had gotten slapped and patted him on the head. Seeing this, the captain suddenly began to let out a low groan.
"Ooh, ooh."
His eyes were red. The groans quickly became contagious.
"Ooh, ooh."
We all let out groans, our eyes red. We kept on groaning, desperate to keep from crying. Since then, whenever we had something unbearably hard or sad happen to us, letting out this mournful groan,
"Ooh, ooh,"
became a secret custom of the basketball team. And so I sat in the middle of the stairs and groaned. Although the station was teeming with rush hour commuters, no one came near me. Occasionally, some young salaryman in a suit grumpily clicked his tongue at me.
You guys are my enemies.
The face of Jong-il, my steady ally, floated into my head. I gave up groaning and talked to Jong-il.
So what was that awesome thing you wanted to tell me about? Was it more awesome than mitochondrial DNA? Was it the secret to ridding the world of discrimination, something like that?
It really would be awesome if something like that really existed.
Hey, you didn't get a girlfriend, did you?